Last conference of Dr. White with Katie, Joe.
Katie Lord was. It's always the woman, you know.
Adam and Eve situation.
No! No! I'd rather have Adam and Eve than Adam and Eve.
Thanks very much. We all thank very warmly Dr. White for putting us back in contact, many of us, including myself, with the English heritage. Surely if there are two expressibles, or two people that express the modern English soul, they are Shakespeare and Dickens.
I'll add a third.
Who's that?
Chaucer.
Chaucer. Well, he's at least medieval.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Modern soul.
Modern soul, yes. Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
So, and very interesting that Dickens was told by the spirit that he should be a Catholic.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And he should have been, but, well, yeah. But there we are. Doctor, please.
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is the last of these. They are of varied quality because they were done quickly yesterday morning in a ghastly London hotel. A bold, brave Episcopal knight spoke words that gave few souls delight. The world cursed, raged, and clucked as it flung its foul muck, but he never abandoned the fight. So, there we are. Yeah. Yeah. And were he to do so, then he would be the first to tell us to ignore what he's saying. So, yeah. But it seems somehow unlikely. I'm going to start off with, this is what I would tell my students. This is a transition. So I'm going to transition from last night's discussion of Bleak House into a novel written by Dickens 3 years later in 1854 called Hard Times. There are certain germs of Hard Times that can be found in Bleak House, and I didn't go into those last night. I saved them for today so that we could have this link. Hard Times is the shortest of Dickens' novels. It's a little book compared to the other giant books. So if you want to just get your feet wet with Dickens and aren't quite ready to plunge into the depths, then this would be a good place to start, although it's unique in certain ways, and I'll say a bit about that in a moment. But it begins with a concern about education. It seems at the beginning to be a book about education. And there is an episode that occurred while he was writing Bleak House that he incorporates into Bleak House that already suggests he was very disturbed about certain things that were happening in educating the young. This is an actual little bit of dialogue that he printed in, that he had read in a newspaper, and he republished in one of his own periodicals. He had two different magazines that he edited later in his life, and he found this so shocking that he republished it. This is an interview, a cross-examination of a 14-year-old boy by the name of George Ruby, who earned his living sweeping mud and manure from the streets of London. An alderman named Humphrey is speaking with him and says to him, to the boy, "Do you ever say your prayers?" Boy, "No, never." Alderman, "Do you know what prayers are?" Boy, "No." Alderman, "Do you know who God is?" Boy, "No." Alderman, "Do you know what the devil is?" Boy, "No, I've heard of the devil, but I don't know him." Alderman, "What do you know, my poor fellow?" Boy, "I knows how to sweep the crossing." Alderman, "And that's all?" Boy, "That's all. I sweeps the crossing." Terrifying. And as it's very clear, the seed of the character Joe in Bleak House, the little sweep, is right there. But it's also very clear that the most basic things that human beings have to know not being conveyed to the young, and certainly not to those who are poor and destitute, as this little boy was. Then there's another side of this, and this This is the other side of total lack of education, or the twisting and misapplication of education that Dickens would pursue throughout Hard Times. In Bleak House, there's another family, and in fact, Michael reminded me last night of them. I had forgotten, because I was going to link them with today's lecture, called the Smallweeds. Let me introduce you to the Smallweeds. Mr. Smallweed's grandfather is in a helpless condition as to his lower and nearly so as to his upper limbs, but his mind is unimpaired. It holds as well as it ever held the first four rules of arithmetic and a certain small collection of the hardest facts. In respect of ideality, reverence, wonder, and other such phrenological attributes, it is no worse off than it used to be. Everything that Mr. Smallweed's grandfather ever put away in his mind was a grub at first and is a grub at last. In all his life, he has never bred a single butterfly. The father of this pleasant grandfather of the neighborhood of Mount Pleasant was a horny-skinned, two-legged, money-getting species of spider who spun webs to catch unwary flies and retired into holes until they were entrapped. The name of this old pagan's god was compound interest. He lived for it, married it, died of it. Meeting with a heavy loss in an honest little enterprise in which all the loss was intended to have been on the other side, he broke something, something necessary to his existence. Therefore, it couldn't have been his heart, and made an end of his career. During the whole time consumed in the small growth of this family tree, the house of Smallweed, always early to go out and late to marry, had strengthened itself in its practical character, had discarded all amusements, discountenanced all storybooks, fairy tales, fictions, and fables, and banished all levities whatsoever. Hence the gratifying fact that it had no children born to it, and the complete little men and women whom it has produced have been observed to bear a likeness to old monkeys with something depressing on their minds. And then he hammers it home one last time, speaking of the two children, Judy. They're twins. Judy never owned a doll, never heard of Cinderella, never played at any game. She once or twice fell into children's company when she was about 10 years old, but the children couldn't get on with Judy, and Judy couldn't get on with them. She seemed like an animal of another species, and there was instinctive repugnance on both sides. It is very doubtful whether Judy knows how to laugh. Her twin brother couldn't wind up a top for his life. He knows no more of Jack the Giant Killer or of Sinbad the Sailor than he knows of the people in the stars. He could as soon play at leapfrog or at cricket as change into a cricket or a frog himself. There is the seed for the beginning of Hard Times, and it was an educational idea that had taken hold at the time, and that was all of those amusements, delights, fairy stories, play, laughter, trivialities that blocked the real education and prevented real education from being done. You will see the link. I'm going to read you the very opening of Hard Times. It's very clear what was on Dickens' mind, and he takes that seed, and it grows into a little tree, but a full-grown tree. Chapter 1, The One Thing Needful. Now, what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts. In this life, we want nothing but facts, sir, nothing but facts. The speaker and the schoolmaster and the third grown person present all backed a little and swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels, then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. The speaker is Mr. Thomas Gradgrind, who's an education specialist, who has his own school, who is teaching little children, including his own two children, Louisa and Thomas Jr. And these are the principles on which he runs his school. Just a few other... This is wonderful. There's a little girl there who doesn't belong. She has come there because she is a refugee from the local circus troupe that's appearing on the edge of town. And he has agreed to take her into the school to try to teach her. Thomas Gradgrind now presented Thomas Gradgrind to the little pitchers before him who were to be filled so full of facts. Indeed, as he eagerly sparkled at them from the cellarage before mentioned, he seemed a kind of cannon loaded to the muzzle with facts and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge. He seemed a galvanizing apparatus, too, charged with a grim mechanical substitute for the tender young imaginations that were to be stormed away. "Girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. "I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?" "Sissy Jupe, sir," explained girl number 20, blushing, standing up and curtsying. "Sissy is not a name," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia." "It's father as calls me Sissy, sir," returned the young girl in a trembling voice and with another curtsy. "Then he has no business to do it," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Tell him he mustn't. Cecilia Jupe, let me see. What is your father?" "He belongs to the horse riding, if you please, sir." Mr. Gradgrind frowned and waved off the objectionable calling with his hand. "We don't want to know anything about that here. You mustn't tell us about that here. Your father breaks horses, don't he?"
"If you please, sir, when they can get any to break, they do break horses in the ring, sir."
"You mustn't tell us about the ring here. Very well, then. Describe your father as a horse breaker. He doctors sick horses, I dare say." "Oh, yes, sir." "Very well, then. He is a veterinary surgeon, a farrier, and a horse breaker. Give me your definition of a horse."
Sissy Jupe, thrown into the greatest alarm by this demand.
"Girl number 20, unable to define a horse," said Mr. Gradgrind, for the general behoof of all the other little pitchers. "Girl number 20 possessed of no facts in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy's definition of a horse. Bitzer, yours, your definition of a horse."
And the little, well, we know already, okay, Bitzer, the name gives him away.
"Quadruped, crominivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth, and 12 incisive, sheds coat in the spring, in marshy country sheds hoofs too, hoofs hard, but requiring to be shod with iron, age known by marks in mouth."
This and much more, Bitzer. "Now, girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, "you know what a horse is." It's just brilliant. The horrifying thing is, Dickens took that definition from an actual book that was out at the time, a book called The Store of Knowledge by a gentleman named Charles Knight, who had put definition after definition after definition like that, and indeed was the source of much of the Gradgrind school, which was the only necessary learning. Make the little pitchers fill up with facts. That's all they need in this world. If they should stray at all into the world of art, then they were given this kind of definition. This also comes from a man named Richard Redgrave, who founded the School of Practical Art. This shows up later in that same chapter. Redgrave had recently published a lecture in which he insisted that taste depended upon, quote, acknowledged principles and rules rather than innate feelings or perception. He declared that in the light of such principles, the, quote, colors must be arranged together in specific and absolute quantities to be agreeable to the eye. This is precisely the kind of statement which Dickens rejected and despised, and the fruit of Mr. Redgrave's remarks found in the opening pages of the novel itself, quote, and again, this is Gradgrind speaking, "You must use combinations and modifications in primary colors of mathematical figures which are susceptible of proof and demonstration. This is the new discovery. This is fact. This is taste. Tell it to Michelangelo and Raphael. And This was going on at the time. There's also an education specialist in the classroom with my favorite of all Dickens' names. He's a Scotsman who is specialized in education, named McChokemchild. and of course, that is exactly what is happening in the classroom. Now, what we find out early on, and it is it's actually extremely sad, is that there is an effect that is being produced on these children. They are turning into what their teachers want them to be. And we get the first example of it in Gradgrind's own daughter, Louisa, and of course, Thomas Jr. There was an air of jaded sullenness in them both, and particularly in the girl. Yet struggling through the dissatisfaction of her face, there was a light with nothing to rest upon, a fire with nothing to burn, a starved imagination keeping life in itself somehow, which brightened its expression, not with the brightness natural to cheerful youth, but with uncertain, eager, doubtful flashes which had something painful in them, analogous to the changes on a blind face groping its way. She speaks to her father, "I am tired, father." This is a little girl. "I am tired, father. I have been tired a long time," said Louisa. "I don't know of what. Of everything, I think." "Oh, no, tired of what?" said the astonished father. "I don't know of what. Of everything, I think," says Louisa. There is a family crisis almost immediately. Young Louisa and young Thomas Jr. sneak out after the school and go and are peeking through the circus tent to look at the clowns and the horse riders and the jugglers. And on his way home, their father sees them. And is the most wicked thing that the children could possibly do, according to his philosophy. He drags them home, and in a rage to his wife, who is a poor ground-down soul herself, who has had, well, needless to say, since Mr. Gradgrind doesn't believe in the heart or the educated heart and doesn't think there's any necessity for the heart of his own home, his wife, has withered and barely exists there. "We were peeping at the circus," muttered Louisa without lifting her eyes. "And father caught us." "And Mrs. Gradgrind," said her husband in a lofty manner, "I should as soon have expected to find my children reading poetry." Now, you should probably already get a sense. There's comedy here, but it's fairly dark. There are probably fewer big comic characters in this novel than in any other Dickens novel. And it's one reason that he makes it short and intense. He has a specific point to make, and he doesn't have time for the usual delight of exaggerating and creating and spreading his imagination around. He needs to make the point as clearly as possible. G.K. Chesterton says there's something in the book that is cold, and I think it's because of the lack of big comic characters. But Chesterton also says, and he's right, that Dickens wrote this book with a gauntlet fist of steel. Just as in the past he had been critical of what was happening with working children and with the poor and with the terrible schools that brutalize children, he is now looking at a different kind of brutality. These are not evil schoolmasters who are beating the young. These are crazy schoolmasters who are denying the young the most essential part of an education. And if there is one phrase that sums up Dickens' entire career, it is that what is absolutely necessary for all human beings is not just the education of the mind, but the education of the heart. And Dickens makes clear through all the novels that without the education of the heart, the human being will be cold and withered. You see it everywhere. You see it in every single one of the novels. And in this novel, he's presenting it in very broad, very direct, and very hard strokes. Gradgrind goes on, berating his poor children for what they have done. And then, making very clear that he wants no nonsense about his own children. By nonsense, says Dickens, he meant fancy. And truly it is probable Louisa was as free from any alloy of that nature as any human being not arrived at the perfection of an absolute idiot ever was. She is not allowed to have an imagination. She is not allowed to wool gather or dream or let her fancy run, because her father will not permit it. It is not part of his education system. There are small bits of the plot I'm going to have to give away, and I regret doing so, but I will hold back on some of it. You're going to get a few things, not all of it. Quick remark about Thomas Gradgrind Jr. If it affects his sister in making her cold and distant and very unhappy, it affects the boy in a different way. Chapter is called The Whelp. It was very remarkable that a young gentleman who had been brought up under one continuous system of unnatural restraint should be a hypocrite, but it was certainly the case with Tom. It was very strange that a young gentleman who had never been left to his own guidance for 5 consecutive minutes should be incapable at last of governing himself. But so it was with Tom. It was altogether unaccountable that a young gentleman whose imagination had been strangled in his cradle should still be inconvenienced by its ghost in the form of groveling sensualities, but such a monster, beyond all doubt, was Tom. He has been turned into a hypocrite who cannot control himself in any way, cannot govern himself in any way, and is a monster of passions. Now, I'm going to make a leap before I move on, and it's very sad, but it's essentially this. Dickens was raging about what was going on in his own time, described what it was that would happen as a result of such miseducation, but he was also prophetic. Throughout the last century and now into this century, education specialists have taken hold. They're everywhere. And they have a stranglehold on the field of education. I taught for 40 years. I was fortunate enough to be given a teaching award at the Naval Academy as one of the finest professors that taught there. It was a great honor. I've been a regular on a nationwide network American radio show talking about Shakespeare. The tapes that I have done that were done at the seminary have gone everywhere, and I keep hearing that they are out there and people are listening to them. I have edited a Shakespeare dictionary. I am known to know my subject, and I could not go back and teach at the high school which I graduated from. It would not be allowed. I graduated in 1966 as valedictorian at that high school, and now if I went back and said I would like to teach a class, they would have to say no. And the reason is I don't have an education degree, and they will only hire those who have been given the phony piece of paper claiming they have a degree. Now, my years at the Naval Academy, obviously I was not teaching young teachers. I was turning out officers, young men and insanely women heading into the military. So I wasn't turning out teachers, but the 5 years I taught at Temple University, I had a number of students who were planning to become educators. And what that meant was they had to get an education degree and take many courses, 10, 12, 14 courses in education theory. But if they were going out to teach English language and literature, they only needed to take 3 courses in the subject they were going to teach. 3 as opposed to a dozen. And what was happening in those education courses was that Mr. McChokemchild and Mr. Gradgrind were in charge and training their minds as to how to approach their students, and it was basically to fill them with facts. It was not teaching. It was social engineering. And what has happened since that time is that it's gotten even madder. And by the time I left the Naval Academy in my own department, which was an English department, more and more time was spent gathering statistics so they would have assessment numbers. Assessment was the big deal when I left, again, from the educational theorists, where everything had to be assessed. How much the students knew, how much the teachers were teaching, what sort of progress was being made. And the only comment I ever made as I was forced to attend these assessment sessions was, all assessment begins with an ASS. At which point I was, well, I never was popular among my colleagues, but you have to jump on any bandwagon if you're going to go forward. It reached the point where for a while they would send out every 6 weeks pages of questions to be filled in by all of us who were teaching plebe English, freshman literature. I'm not making this up. In the previous 6 weeks, did student X show great advancement in his ability to properly use commas? Did he show advancement in his understanding of the participle and the use of the participle? And then they would take these sheets, correlate them, and come out with statistics as to how much the students were learning and how well I was teaching them, because they had the numbers to show it. I would sit through tenure meetings and meetings about offering my fellow professors special courses in the department to teach. And they would sit around and pull out the student evaluations. And this professor got 17.5% excellence, 22% 3 excellence, 47.8% average excellence. So, and they would go over these numbers and by that make life-changing decisions. Facts. Statistics. And as a result of this, my own profession, and I think my friend Patrick would agree, his profession, which was history, slowly degenerated into nothing more than politics. What they were really teaching was politics and doing social engineering, trying to turn out not little vessels filled with facts, but tiny little robots who would spout predictable phrases when pointed in the right direction and given a little hint of what they were expected to say. It is a very frightening vision, but Dickens was indeed at the core of it. Dickens realized there was another way. This is too beautiful. I read this paragraph. It's the wretched ignorance of Sissy Jupe, who grew up in the circus, knew real people, had a real father, and the sorrow is he realized he was getting old, couldn't perform with the horses anymore, and disappears, deserts, and takes a little family dog named Merrylegs with him. Sissy doesn't know what's happened to her father. She holds on to the little bottle of ointment with which she used to rub his sore muscles at night after a long day with the horses. But she doesn't, and she has been sent. Mr. Gradgrind finally agrees to take her into the school, much to his chagrin. The wretched ignorance with which Jupe clung to her consolation, rejecting the superior comfort of knowing on a sound arithmetical basis that her father was an unnatural vagabond, filled Mr. Gradgrind with pity. There's no such thing as love and forgiveness and hope. Yet what was to be done? McChuckumchild reported that she had a very dense head for figures, that once possessed with a general idea of the globe, she took the smallest conceivable interest in its exact measurements, that she was extremely slow in the acquisition of dates, unless some pitiful incident happened to be connected therewith, that she would burst into tears on being required by the mental process immediately to name the cost of 247 muslin caps at 14 pence halfpenny, that she was as low down in the school as low could be, that after 8 weeks of induction into the elements of political economy, she had only yesterday been set right by a prattler 3 feet high for returning to the question, what is the first principle of this science? The absurd answer, to do unto others as I would that they should do unto me. What does one do with such profound ignorance? One gets it out of the schools. No religious training in the schools. And if you begin introducing the great literature, the great music, the great art, a sense of the history of the past, religion is going to creep in, and therefore the logical thing to do, and it's been done in the modern schools, is you get rid of literature and music and the arts and history. And especially, poetry. Whoa! Okay? And it's gone. It's not important anymore. We have to have budget cuts, we got rid of the art courses. We have more budget cuts, there goes the school band, there goes the school choir. We've got more budget cuts, Make the history professors teach larger classes. We've got even more budget cuts. Well, expand the literature and writing courses to 50 students, but we don't need that literature. And indeed, for a while I taught at Temple University, we in the English department were not allowed to teach literature in the freshman composition courses. No literature. Because all they need to do is learn the principles of writing, the facts of how to write a sentence. Now, the result of this is not just the drying up and death of the heart, but the coming of an immense stupidity, an overwhelming stupidity that is absolutely breathtaking. Favorite story of mine, former student of mine, very bright, when he graduated, was sent to the Naval Academy Preparatory School. These were the students coming in who were too dumb to even begin the work at the Naval Academy, most of them recruited for sports, which is a very high good because it has to do with the functioning of the body, i.e. life, which is the highest good in the modern world. So they would send them for a year to pretend to get them ready for the very, very tough curriculum of the Naval Academy. Well, one of my former students went to teach English at the preparatory school. So it's his first class. He's never taught before. He thought, well, I got to find out where these guys are. They were mostly big lunks, future football players. So he said to them, I want you to write a sentence. Write me a sentence. And he gathered them in, and he's going through them, and he comes on one, and the big lunk had written down, the cat. And he said to him, Mr. Lunk, this isn't a sentence. Oh? No, it's a... Why not? Well, with a sentence, you need a subject and a predicate. Huh? A sentence is comprised of a subject and a predicate. Do you know what those are? Uh-uh. You need a noun. Do you know what a noun is? Uh-uh. You need a thing, and then you need an action word. Oh. Okay, that's a sentence. Oh, okay. Now try again. He takes it back, thinks a while, and writes, hands it in. The young man looks at it, and it reads, the big cat. Now, there is a measure of delight and imagination in that, I have to admit, but it's not quite what was being looked for. This catastrophe this catastrophe. I could give countless more examples. I'll just say one other thing, because I rarely get a chance to publicly demean this man, so let me do it here. The education specialist, the education columnist for our local paper, which we call the Washington Compost, has blathered on for years. I've been reading him for years about education and this program and that way of teaching and these standards and how these courses should be run and what we give to these students and which new group of absolute idiots have drawn up a new education scheme that will save education and turn the dullest bulb into the brightest light. And it just goes on and on, two columns a week. And finally, after years of reading this bozo, in one of the columns he admitted he had never, ever spent one day teaching in an actual classroom. Ever. All abstract theory. But that was sufficient to get him his job. And indeed, every school administration is chock full of these people who only understand what they call education in the abstract and indeed are merely concerned with advancing their theories, and higher and higher and higher they go. I could go on for ages. I think I've made my point. They are in control. They've done their work. They have dried up the heart. They have programmed the head and turned out little robots, and it leads to the second major theme in Hard Times. Why do we need robots? So we can send the robots off to do the work we want them to do. And just rest assured, they'll do whatever we tell them. Now, in Dickens' time, he links it up with poor factory workers. And I mentioned earlier yesterday, the father of my dear friend, who worked his life away year after year building tires in a tire factory. A very hard job. A very sweet man. What he did, and God bless him, he went to the factory, he built tires, he earned his income. Even though he was very sick as a result of World War II, he came home, he provided for his wife, he provided for his family. He was very good. He was a very good man. And I somehow think one reason for that is he knew David Copperfield, read it every year, and loved it. His heart never withered and died. But in Hard Times, the factory town and the factory being presented is a place where hearts have withered and died, and the workers are poor drudges who are simply there to perpetually make money for those above them. Dickens calls this town Coketown. Let me give you a very, very quick, again, it's magnificent. A great writer, a great prose writer. It was a town of red brick, or of brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. Notice the similarity to the fog at the beginning of Bleak House. Just this sense of dirt and desperation and uncleanliness. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and ever and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye and vast piles of building full of windows where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It's just a magnificent image of one of those machines, just up and down and up and down and up. The image of a head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It contains several large streets, all very like one another, and many small streets, still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another, who all went in and out at the same hours, with the same sound upon the same pavements to do the same work, and to whom every day was the same as yesterday and tomorrow, and every year the counterpart of the last and the next. You understand why the great Mr. Eliot loved Dickens. His image of them shuffling over the bridge to go to work in the morning, all those dead souls. And Eliot quotes Dante, "I did not know death had undone so many, except these are living dead souls." The horrible conditions under which poor modern men work. The soulless, life-killing, stifling conditions. But to get them to do that, they have to have been socially engineered. They had to have gone through the fact factory. They had to have been programmed. One other detail here, which is again, so prescient I can't believe it. He's talking about Coketown. The jail might have been the infirmary. The infirmary might have been the jail. The town hall might have been either, or both, or anything else, for anything that appeared to the contrary in the graces of their construction. All the buildings are the same. In the modern world, the prisons look like the libraries, which look like the city hall, which looks like the hospital, which looks like the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's this lean, clean, modern architecture. Kleenex boxes stood on end or tipped over. Concrete and steel. Or new hotels with steel and plexiglass and modern conveniences that are inconvenient and that no human being can possibly make function. He saw that coming, and why not? It's part of the monotony, the dullness, the deadness. Now, ruling over Coketown is Mr. Bounderby. It is very interesting that in this book, where Dickens is describing the loss of imagination, of fancy, of that world of fairy tale and story and song and music and joy and laughter, he structures much of the book as a fairy tale. Mr. Bounderby is said to live in a giant's castle. There's a woman I'm not going to mention, great character, you need to read it just to meet her, named Mrs. Sparsit, who's referred to by people as the wicked dragon lady of the bank, okay? You have all these references. It's as if, in the midst of this hard realism, the romance still rises up in him. He's constructing a fairy story, okay? And it is Dickens, so we know where the ending is going to be, but boy, it's tough getting there. This is a really tough fairy story, where it's not easy to have a magical, quick, happy ending. Anyway, Mr. Bounderby lives in his castle, and Mr. Bounderby is very proud of himself because he had a miserable, horrible youth, of which he reminds everyone constantly. It's part of his constant recitation about what he went through. "I was born with inflammation of the lungs and of everything else, I believe, that was capable of inflammation. For years, ma'am, I was one of the most miserable little wretches ever seen. I was so sickly that I was always moaning and groaning. I was so ragged and dirty that you wouldn't have touched me with a pair of tongs. How I fought through it, I don't know. I was determined, I suppose. I have been a determined character in later life, and I suppose I was then. Here I am, anyhow, and nobody thanked for my being here but myself. My mother left me to my grandmother, and according to the best of my remembrance, my grandmother was the wickedest and the worst old woman that ever lived. If I got a little pair of shoes by any chance, she would take them off and sell them for drink. Why, I have known that grandmother of mine lie in her bed and drink her 14 glasses of liquor before breakfast. She kept a chandler's shop and kept me in an egg box. That was the cot of my infancy, an old egg box. As soon as I was big enough to run away, of course I ran away. Then I became a young vagabond, and instead of one old woman knocking me about and starving me, everybody of all ages knocked me about and starved me. They were right. They had no business to do anything else. I was a nuisance, an encumbrance, and a pest. I knew that very well." We find out later in the novel, I hate to give it away, you're not surprised, not a word of it is true. It's a total lie. But it is, again, The earliest example I know of what you hear constantly among the big money makers, the big money men, those who are very rich, and the phrase they use is, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. I came from humble beginnings. It was a hard life. But I worked and I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. And indeed, Bounderby is very clear. If I could do it, why can't my workers do it? If they really cared, if they really worked, if they were really dedicated, they could become as rich and powerful and as successful as I am. They are the problem. They have no will, no capacity to work, no vision of... Among modern capitalism, Bounderby's name is legion. Legion. Well, needless to say, in the midst of all this, there's another side. If Bounderby is the vision of capitalism, and indeed, here's a quick definition. Dickens was well aware of the capitalist. Capitalism was the fiction of Coketown. Any capitalist there who had made £60,000 out of sixpence always professed to wonder why the 6,000 interest nearest hands didn't each make £60,000 out of sixpence, and more or less reproached them, everyone, for not accomplishing the little feat. What I did, you can do. Why don't you go and do it? Get out there and get rich. I'm rich. I did it. Get out there and do it. There's the image. But on the other side, and this is the glory of Dickens, and it's the reason those advanced economic thinkers of the day remained very annoyed with him and tried to turn him into something he was not. He has an equally grim view of the collectivists. What is going on in Coketown is that the first union is being organized. And the man who is the head of the union is named Slackbridge, and he's every bit as awful as Bounderby. Just give you the beginning of his first address to the new worker. They're called the United Aggregate Tribunal. Oh, my friends, the downtrodden operatives of Coketown. Oh, my friends and fellow countrymen, the slaves of an iron-handed and grinding despotism. Oh, my friends and fellow sufferers and fellow workmen and fellow men, I tell you that the hour is come when we must rally round one another as one united power and crumble into dust the oppressors that too long have battened upon the plunder of our families, upon the sweat of our brows, upon the labor of our hands, upon the strength of our sinews, upon the God-created glorious rights of humanity, and upon the holy and eternal privileges of brotherhood. Good, good. Hear, hear, they shout. He's a rhetorician. He's a blowhard. He's as every bit phony as Bounderby, who he claims to be in opposition with. Dickens had gone to see a strike that took place in a town called Preston. I think it's in Lancashire. Okay, and he had witnessed what was going on in terms of the strike happening there. And he came away from it with a clear sense of a plague of both your houses. He had no time for any of it. He condemned the aggression between the workers and the masters at Preston. And he was condemning the loss of fancy in their lives. He believed something was missing in them that had turned them on each other, and was indeed that sense of imagination to create warm hearts so they could at least deal with each other as human beings. That is why he was so concerned to support educational institutes in the large industrial centers. The delight in fancy, the delight in literature would encourage those virtues of harmony and sympathy, which were essential to maintain decent industrial relations. 3 years before, he criticized a threatened strike by engine drivers and firemen of the Northwestern Rail Line. He stated that, "We must deny the moral right or justification to exert the immense power they accidentally possess to the public detriment and danger. He was not unsympathetic to the workers' case, as he said. We firmly believe these are honest men as the world can produce. His complaint was the organizers of the strike, who are sometimes not workmen at all, but designing persons who have, for their own base purposes, enmeshed the workmen in a system of tyranny and oppression. In the following year, he made similar comments about a strike being organized by the Amalgamated Society of Engineers. Honorable, generous, and spirited themselves, they have fallen into an unlucky way of trusting their affairs to contentious men who work them up in a state of conglomeration and irritation. In the same way he saw the problems coming with organized charity, he saw the problems coming with organized contention between the big bosses and the big leaders of labor movements. And what was being lost in the midst of all of this was simple, decent humanity. And one reason for it being lost was because of the heartlessness of the education they were all being subjected to. It has just occurred to me, almost at the same time that Dickens was writing this, Wagner was beginning work on his Ring Cycle. This really is very like the evil dwarf Alberic, who is the master of the Nibelungens, and just keeps them working in these hideous conditions and whipping them in order to keep them churning out these things that he demands of them. And the reason he can become the lord of the Nibelungens and the ruler of this little kingdom of his is he has given up love in order to steal the gold, the Nibelung gold, becomes his own. He had to renounce love. It's very interesting. Two different countries, two immense geniuses, very different means of presentation, although do notice Wagner's is a gigantic combination of fairy tale, fable, myth, and a good deal of realism about human nature. These great geniuses thought alike at a certain time and had a real sense of what was happening. Now, there's one other type that is produced by all this, and he enters the book about halfway through. His name is James Harthouse, and he is sent to Coketown in order to become their representative in the government. And once again, Dickens is presenting a very low view of politics by choosing this particular man as a representative of who is recruited to represent the people. The Gradgrind Party wanted assistance in cutting the throats of the Graces. If we're going to kill off art, if we're going to kill off Grace, we need political help. They went about recruiting, and where could they enlist recruits more hopefully than among the fine gentlemen who, having found out everything to be worth nothing, were equally ready for anything. And so James Harthouse shows up. We find out. He had tried life as a cornet of dragoons and found it a bore. Had afterwards tried it in the train of an English minister abroad and found it a bore. And had then strolled to Jerusalem and got bored there. And had then gone yachting about the world and got bored everywhere. To whom his honorable brother said one day, "Jim, there's a good opening among the hard fact fellows. They want men. I wonder you don't go in for statistics." Jim, taken with the novelty of the idea and very hard up for a change, was ready to go in for statistics as anything else. So he went in, coached himself with a blue book or two, put himself among the hard fact fellows, and said, "A handsome dog," his brother says, "a handsome dog who can make you a devilish good speech, he's your man." After a few dashes in the public meeting way, Mr. Gradgrind and a council of political sages approved of Jem and was resolved to send him down to Coketown to become known therein in the neighborhood and as a result, he becomes the representative of Coketown. He's an absolute cad. And Louisa, having been forced by her father, not surprisingly, to marry Bounderby, is in a miserable marriage. And James Harthouse gets very interested with her for the simple reason that she seems every bit as empty as he himself is. He's speaking to her, and I quote, he's seducing her. Speaking of hypocrites, whom none of us believe, my dear Mrs. Bounderby, and who do not believe themselves. The only difference between us and the professors of virtue or benevolence or philanthropy, never mind the name, is that we know it is all meaningless and say so, while they know it equally and will never say so. She's startled by this. She's never heard anybody talk this way. It was worse for her at this pass, that in her mind a struggling disposition to believe in a wider and nobler humanity than she had ever heard of strove with doubts and resentments. With doubts because the aspiration had been so laid waste in her youth. With resentments because of the wrong that had been done her, if it were indeed a whisper of the truth. Upon a nature so long accustomed to self-suppression, thus torn and divided, the Harthouse philosophy came as a relief and justification. Everything became hollow and worthless. She had missed nothing and sacrificed nothing. What did it matter, she had said to her father when he proposed her husband. What did it matter, she said still. With a scornful self-reliance, she asked herself, what did anything matter, and went on. And now she meets a man who is equally empty and justifies the emptiness within her. And we have a moral crisis, because how could she ever know morality without ever having been taught the good and the bad and how one decides? How it works it out is fascinating. I'm not going to go there. You can read that yourself. But please notice something. The end of all this system, in Mr. Harthouse, is boredom. You talk to the youth today, and their constant cry is, I'm bored. Oh, it's so boring. I don't like this. It's boring. This is boring. That is boring. It used to be a constant cry of my students, whatever I assigned them. I would assign them Moby Dick. I'd assign them Pride and Prejudice. I'd assign them King Lear. And they'd come in and they'd say, oh, it's so boring. And I'd say, no, 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 great art is a mirror. The book isn't boring. You are boring. And that, yes. then they'd be taken aback. Or as the great Russian writer Nikolai Gogol would say, don't blame the mirror if your face is crooked. But the fact of the matter is they think themselves self-sufficient. Religion is boring. Education is boring. Everything is boring. The movies they love are boring, because that was last week. What's the new one? How did you like it? Oh, it was okay. It was boring. The new bands are boring, okay? The new Puss Casserole CD comes out, and well, I like the old one. This one is boring. Over and boredom, 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 which is a reflection of pure nihilism. They believe in nothing. Nothing. Because they've been given nothing. Dickens in 1854 is onto it, sees it coming, describes it, and it's very, very frightening. Dickens says of Mr. Harthouse, when the devil goeth about like a roaring lion, he goeth about in a shape by which few but savages and hunters are attracted. But when he is trimmed, smoothed, and varnished, according to the mode, when he is aweary of vice and aweary of virtue, used up as to brimstone and used up as to bliss, then, whether he take to the serving out of red tape or to the kindling of red fire, He is the very devil. And James Harthouse has become the very devil. In the midst of this, there is a poor individual worker, one of the hands at the factory, whose life is just miserable. Name of Stephen Blackpool. I'm not going to tell you a story, you can read it. I only say this. He gets stuck between Bounderby and the union leaders. And Bounderby detests him because he's a betrayer. He's betrayed his own kind. Bounderby may be against the hands, but he can only manipulate them if they're a group. He can only deal with them if they're a group. An individual steps out of the group. He doesn't know what to do about it. His fellow hands hate him because they're not unified. There is one of them who has stood out apart from the group and won't have anything to do with them, and has indeed said that he thinks what they're doing is wrong and it's not good and they shouldn't be doing it that way, although he's very sympathetic to them. They allow him one moment to speak, one moment, and he says, "My brothers and fellow workmen, for that you are to me, though not as I knows on to this delicate ear, I have but a word to say, and could say no more if I was to speak till strike a day. I know well what's afore me. I know well that you all resolve to have no more ado with a man who is not with you in this matter. I know well that if I was a lion perished in the road, you'd feel it right to pass me by as a foreigner and stranger. What I have gotten, I must make the best on." It is a denial of the parable of the Good Samaritan. You would all pass me by. Bounderby would pass me by. I have nothing to rely on. That works itself out in a heartbreaking, brilliant way that I can't read to you because I couldn't get through it. It would be the end of the talk. Now, this has all been very dark. So, let's go to the circus. Because in the midst of all this darkness, the world of bad education, of horrible factories, of capitalist, prideful liars and pompous asses, of unionizers who are forwarding the collective and turning men into just digits that they can use for their own aggrandizement, we meet Mr. Sleary, the owner of the circus. And we meet a number of the other characters of the circus. I wish I could introduce you to them all. They are just wonderful. They are just wonderful. But here's Mr. Sleary. Where Dickens is giving us a little tour of the circus, and we're meeting all the various types there, who you wouldn't meet out on the street, most likely. There's a reason they banded together and traveling together. Last of all appeared Mr. Sleary. A stout man, as already mentioned, with one fixed eye and one loose eye, a voice, if it can be called so, like the efforts of a broken old pair of bellows, a flabby surface, and a muddled head which was never sober and never drunk. "Squire," said Mr. Sleary, who was troubled with asthma and whose breath came far too thick and heavy for the letter S, "your servant. This is a bad piece of business, this is. You've heard of my clown and his dog being supposed to have morrised?" A morris dance, disappeared. Mr. Grangrass says, "Yes." "Well, squire, is it your intention to do anything for the poor girl, squire?" "Well, I have something to propose to her when she comes back." "Glad to hear it, squire. Not that I want to get rid of the child any more than I want to stand in her way. I'm willing to take her presence, though in her age is late. My voice is a little husky, squire, and not easy heard by them that don't know me. But if you've been chilled and heated, heated and chilled and heated in the ring when you was young, and often as I have been, your voice wouldn't have lasted out, squire, no more than mine." Let's just say it works out, but before it works out, things have come to a terrible pass. One last quick notion to pull this all together. This is a book of bad marriages, very bad marriages. Dickens was having trouble in his own marriage and had a sense, I think, something had gone wrong. He did eventually part with his wife, separated from her. But he was also aware that there were things happening all around him where marriage itself was coming to crisis. Here is the idiot who wrote the introduction to this volume. Academic. Be very wary of them. Read introductions at your peril. He, first of all, he's furious with Dickens that Dickens is against labor unions. Okay, the guy's obviously, if not a Marxist, certainly a collectivist. But I'll spare you that. Dickens disliked trade unions in the same way he disliked the workhouse or the circumlocution office. It's the first image of the bureaucracy. It's in his novel, The Little Dorrit. One of the characters needs to dig up something from a Bureau of Records and ends up in a place called the Circumlocution Office, where Office 1 sends you to Office 2, to Office 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and you end up back at Office 1 and can't get what you want, and nobody knows what's going on. My favorite is he walks into one office, and there are just two bureaucrats sitting there roasting potatoes over the fireplace. It's quite wonderful. He disliked the unions the same way he disliked the workhouse or the circumlocution office or the House of Commons or the courts of law. They were all of them great or potentially great organizations, and Dickens displayed a marked bias against every form of organized institution. The only unit in which he is interested is the family. Now, it is very interesting. Those of you that know Aristotle's Politics, Aristotle begins his discussion of politics at the basic unit on which all politics is founded has to be the family. Okay? There's a logic to it, and it's one reason politics have now gone completely haywire. It's because the family's gone haywire. He is only interested in the family. Nothing else really matters. His favorite ending is a kind of enormous household reunion. The virtuous characters settle down to a state of perpetual, unbroken domesticity, says the academic from his lofty perch scornfully. And I say, good for Dickens. Good for Dickens. If you don't have a settled down state of perpetual, unbroken domesticity, there will be no religion, no politics, no culture, no life, no society, no neighborhoods. There will be nothing. You're on your way to nihilism, which is where we've landed now. So that all the way through, here's a comment from the Peter Ackroyd biography. It's very good. Louisa Grangrind says at one point that her fancy could have become for her. This is when she accuses her father, a great scene. Read it, a great scene. My fancy could have become my refuge from what is sordid and bad in the real things around me. And it is the view, not that you're not aware of them, but there are times you need to go to a better place, and the imagination can provide it. As we know, the faith can certainly provide it. But again, we're talking about little children first. One educates them in religion, one educates them in any number of other things, not just facts. The loss of imagination is connected by Dickens with the loss of natural affection and with the creation of unnatural families. All the conditions of Dickens' own childhood being reinstated in this alien landscape of factories and furnaces beneath the glaring sky. If you allow this continue, it's a great phrase. I don't know if Ackroyd was aware of it. You're going to end up with unnatural families. I got so tired of being told I was part of the Naval Academy family. I was part of the English Department family. I was all, you know, join this political party and become part of our family. Family. The word was used indiscriminately, sloppily, to the point where I lost all definition. And you want unnatural families now? They're exploding everywhere. Not husband and wife in Catholic marriage to produce children, to make new souls for God. But, God help us, man loves man, woman loves woman, man loves boy, boy loves dog, girl loves horse. I mean, just who knows? Who knows where this insanity is going to stop? I think it will stop pretty clearly since we're recreating Sodom with fire falling from the sky, which takes us all to Akita, Japan. It's pretty clear where we're headed. Read Romans 1. St. Paul makes very clear, this is a punishment by God for abandoning the faith. Unnatural families. Well, I'm going to jump to the end. I have to tell you one thing. I'm going to end my discussion as I properly should, because Dickens really ends the book. He has his little, almost every Dickens novel ends with a kind of theatrical tableau, the way the old melodramas did that he grew up with in the theater. There'd be this final tableau of everything working out the way it should, as I said before, okay? If Dickens is the creator, then Dickens loves his creations, and the good are judged accordingly, and the bad are judged accordingly, and the good are rewarded, and the wicked are punished in his little created world of the novel, okay? So we get that final tableau, but this is the last commentary. And of course, he gives it to wonderful Mr. Sleary. I just love it. 14th month ago, he's talking to Thomas Gradgrind, who's one of those characters who is capable of redemption. Thank goodness. 14 month ago, Squire, since we was at Chester, we was getting up our children in the wood one morning when there cometh into our ring by the stage door a dog. He had traveled a long way. He was in very bad condition. He was lame and pretty well blind. He went round to our children, one after another, as if he was a thecon for a child he knowed. And then he come to me and throwed himself up behind and stood on his two forelegs, weak as he was, and then he wagged his tail and died. Squire, that dog was Merrylegs, Sissy's father's dog, Cecilia's father's old dog. Now, Squire, I can take my oath from my knowledge of that dog that that man was dead and buried before that dog came back to me. Josephine and Childers and me talked it over a long time, whether I should write or not, but we agreed, no, there is nothing comfortable to tell. Why unsettle her mind and make her unhappy? Though whether her father basely deserted her, or whether he broke his own heart alone rather than pull her down along with him, never will be known now, Squire, till we know how the dogs find us out. It seemed to present two things to a person, don't it, Squire? Said Mr. Sleary, musing as he looked down into the depths of his brandy and water. One, that there is a love in the world, not all self-interest after all, but something very different. The other, that it hath a way of its own of calculating or not calculating, which somehow or other is at least as hard to give a name to as the ways of the dog is. Cecilia, my dear, kiss me and goodbye. Miss Squire, to see you treatin' of her like a sister, and a sister that you trust and honor with all your heart and more, is a very pretty sight to me. I hope your brother may live to be better deserving of you and a greater comfort to you. Squire, shake hands, first and last. Don't be cross with us poor vagabonds. People must be amused. They can't always be a learning, nor they can't always be a working. They ain't made for it. You must have us, Squire. Do the wise thing and the kind thing too, and make the best of us, not the worst. And I never thought, said Mr. Sleary, putting his head in at the door again to say it, that I was so much of a cackler. I've cackled long enough. Thank you for listening. Any questions? Any questions? Yes.
Do you have copies? Is it possible to get your lessons about Shakespeare?
Is it possible to get my Shakespeare lectures? Many of them were done at the seminary at His Excellency's invitation. The seminary has currently dumped them all. They went down the same memory hole with His Excellency's sermons, and I'm very proud of it. I can think of no other memory hole I'd rather go down. But they will reappear when the bishop's website is up, and they'll be available again.
Okay.
They will be available again. I have cackled for many years, I'll tell you, but most of them that were recorded were thanks to His Excellency, who someone asked me the story of how I wound up lecturing at the seminary. Maybe I could bore you for a minute. It's a funny story. You can verify the correctness of this. Well, yes. It was, in fact, 25 years ago. 25 years ago in August, the seminary had moved from Ridgefield to Winona. And one of the first things that went on there was His Excellency gave a series of conferences on modernism. Specifically, the most of it looking at Pascendi. And I was born and raised in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, about 90 minutes from Winona, which was fortuitous. And every summer, I went back to Wisconsin. Many years I did summer theater there with the wonderful group of actors. And we amused the population. But I was done with the theater that summer, and I saw that the conferences were being given, and I knew Winona was close by, so I applied. And I think maybe, 20, 25 men showed up. And we got there in the afternoon, and the first conference was that night, and I sat down. The evening meal was prepared before the first conference. And I picked up my glass of water, and the gentleman next to me said, "Don't drink that." And I put my water down, and he said, all the water everywhere is poisoned. They put poisons in it. And you only drink bottled water. You mustn't drink water that comes out of the tap at all." I was, okay. So I looked at my meal, and I forget what the meat was, but I picked up my knife and fork and started to eat the vegetables. I think it was broccoli. And I began... The gentleman on the other side of me said, don't eat the broccoli. And I said, really? He said, no. Chemicals in the ground everywhere. It's not just fertilizer. They're putting hideous chemicals in. It may look like a vegetable, a green vegetable that's good for you, but it's just filled with things. It's poison. You'll kill yourself. So I put my utensils down and thought, what have I got myself into? Why am I here? What has happened? And the gentleman across the table from me saw my dismay and said, "Don't be upset. Don't worry about it. They're good souls. They mean well. You have to realize that, and it's understandable, among traditional Catholics, there are a few crazies. There are a few crazies. But you mustn't become too disturbed by them. They have good hearts and they mean well." And I said, well, thank you. And he said, "But of course we do live in a time when we have to be cautious, and you can't be trusting of everyone. For example, you do know the U.S. government actually has films made on the moon of the crucifixion of our Lord, and they won't release them." Seriously, I pushed my chair away from the table and thought, "I am out of here. That's it. I'm gone. I mean, I'm going to go back and drink brandy and water with my theater friends. This is too much." And then the little voice in my head said, "Somebody's trying to drive you out of here. You stay." And I always listen to what the little voice in my head says, unless it's impossible or not appropriate. And it rarely sets me wrong. So, okay, I'll stay for the first lecture. So we go to the first conference, and His Excellency is making very wonderful remarks. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And then in the midst of it, and I don't remember the connection, he quotes some lines of German. It's gone in my head right now. Schiller, the used by you know who, and the, how does it begin? Schöner.
Schöner vor der Götter von Goethe.
Funken Tochter auf Elysium. All right. Little German quotation. He took a sigh and said, but of course none of you knows what that is. And I said, well, yeah, that's Schiller's Ode to Joy that Beethoven set as the choral movement, the fourth movement of his Ninth Symphony. He said, I'm going to see you in my office immediately after this conference. Whereupon we began talking, and he kindly invited me to come and lecture to the seminarians, and a quarter of a century later, we're still on speaking terms. So. And he still invited me. That's the story in brief. So I'm very happy to have been here and spent the time with you, and I hope to come back again. Thank you very much. Thanks. Well...